Let me introduce myself before we do anything else. I'm Adam. I'm the Associate Minister here at All Saints. And in this seminar, we're just going to be thinking a little bit about how we might go about loving people that we know at school who might be struggling with their gender identity. And to kick us off, I think it would be great to just chat through these questions. It may be in pairs or in threes where you are. But before you do that, let me lead us in a prayer, and then we'll get chatting in groups about those three questions. Let me pray before we do anything else. Father, thank you so much that we get to spend time together as your people thinking through this big topic. Give us wisdom now as we think about how we might best be able to love our friends and our classmates who are struggling with their gender identity. Amen. So you've 5 minutes in groups or pairs just to chat through that question. Go for it. All of them. What do you need?
I'm just going to come and listen to you.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
You can sneak in, take Kathy's chair if you want. Okay. Nice comfy chair.
Right.
Yeah, of course you can. There's a load of chairs, but you might need to grab one from the back.
And that's the other thing. I got an email.
And he's obviously got busy lunch. Yeah,
just about.
So, I've got pens.
He had a whole chain of bringing it back.
Shall we come back together, draw our conversations to a close? I wonder whether anyone might want to share, particularly the answers to question three. How do people at school, people in the world, expect Christians to act towards transgender people? Did you get that far? It's only 5 minutes, wasn't it? Here's what I think the expectation is. From lots of my non-Christian friends. They completely expect me to be transphobic and to be slightly bigoted towards people who struggle with their gender identity. Which is really sad. That the expectation is that Christians will act unpleasantly or prejudicially against people who struggle with gender identity. And all we're going to do in this session is think about the better story. So we'll run through a couple of things, but we'll go through it quickly because it might overlap with a lot of what Andrew has said this morning. And then we'll think more about our response as Christians to people who struggle with their gender identity. And let me just run through three aspects of this better story that the gospel is for people who struggle with their gender identity. Here's the first one. Dignity. Dignity. Our bodies are part of who we are. The language throughout the Old Testament, whenever it talks about God creating people, is deeply physical language. He made us. He knit us together. He formed us from the dust and breathed life into us. He is our creator, and that includes our bodies. So he doesn't just make our minds and our feelings and our emotions. He makes our physicality as well. So what that means is that part of being a creature created by God is having a body that was made by God. Our bodies aren't mistakes. Our bodies aren't obstacles to be overcome. They are a God-given part of what it means to be human. And your body is a God-given part of what it means to be you. And that's really important as well, because these bodies that God has made us with, we are all made in the image of God. And that sets us apart from the rest of creation. In Psalm 8, it tells us that humanity, made in the image of God, has authority over the rest of creation, is indeed the pinnacle of God's creation. The humans are the high point of everything that God has made. Now, I'm imagining we've all come from different churches around Sussex, and so we're all probably pretty familiar with the beautiful Sussex countryside. And we go for walks and we gaze at fields and trees and areas of outstanding natural beauty and the seaside. And it's really easy, isn't it, to be amazed at the beauty of the sea or the beauty of nature or the beauty of a sunset. And yet, in those moments when we are amazed by how beautiful God's creation is, actually, we're not even looking at the best thing that God has made. If you want to see the pinnacle of God's creation, you don't go to a beautiful, isolated countryside scene. You go to the middle of a bustling city where you are surrounded by people made in the image of God, surrounded by the pinnacles of God's creation. And it's really important we get this right, because society often has this really confused understanding of what makes someone valuable. It's all too easy to slip into thinking that value is based on things like what we can contribute to society, or our value is based upon the relationships that we form, or the jobs that we do, or the grades that we get. But the Bible is clear that the reason people are valuable has nothing to do with these things. The reason people are valuable, the reason people are valued by God and should be valued by other people, is because he has made each and every one of us in his own image. So for the trans person struggling with their gender identity, who must so often feel belittled or isolated because of it, well, this offers them a better way forward, an innate dignity that comes from being made by God. It also is a better story because it provides us the only certain way of flourishing. The question, what does my best life look like, is a pretty normal question. Everyone has some understanding of the good life. What does it look like for people to flourish? Well, let me introduce you to Nikki. This is Nikki Hayden. Nikki is a trans woman, which means she was born male, but now identifies as and lives as a woman. And she wrote her story a few years ago in the Guardian newspaper. And I'm just going to read some of it to you. This is Nikki's story. Until I was about 4 or 5, I didn't know I wasn't a girl, to be honest with you. One of my earliest memories, about 5 years old, was being yelled at by a teacher for going to the toilet with the girls. About the same time, I realised I was different to these other boys. At the age of 9, I refused to have my hair cut. I didn't have it cut until I was 16, because having it cut was such a torment to me. School was extremely difficult. I got bullied a lot. I was picked on for being too thin, for being feminine, for not liking football, for hanging around with girls, for having long hair. They mocked everything they could think of in terms of gender and sexuality. I learned what trans meant through YouTube. I knew how I felt, but I didn't know that there was a term for it. I was basically just trying to Google what I felt. A light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, this explains all the issues I've had for as long as I can remember. I never really told my family. They know, but I just started transitioning. I never said, oh, by the way, my mum asked me if I was transgender when I was around 19, after I'd already transitioned. She said, well, are you? And I was like, are you blind? On a day-to-day basis, I don't tell people I'm transgender. The thing about trans people is we feel very normal. It's the way we are. It's only when people say you're not normal that you feel that way. I've always been extremely feminine. I always felt that way. I can't say that I ever felt like a boy. I just had to live as a boy for the first 16 years of my life. Trans people are the same as everyone else. Our ideals in life are to be happy, to be respected, to be comfortable. I've had people who have openly said to me that they've had prejudices around trans people, but as soon as they've met me, they've understood more. It's who I am and the way I was born. There's no real difference between myself and people who are cisgender, which just means non-transgender. The thing I find most striking about Nikki's story is how incredibly normal her hopes and her desires for life are. They're nothing out of the ordinary. It is what she says in the final paragraph. Trans people are the same as everyone else. Our ideals in life are to be happy, to be respected, to be comfortable. But we all want that. All Nikki wants is a degree of happiness, respect and comfort. It's so normal. Nikki wants a good life. Nikki wants to flourish. And so we've got to ask the question, what does God say? How does our Creator say that we flourish? And in John 10, verse 10, Jesus says this, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. See, Jesus here has been debating with the Pharisees, and he makes two big claims. He says, I am the good shepherd, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I love my followers so much that I'm willing to die for them. And then he says, he starts by saying, I have come so that people can have life to the full, so that people can flourish. Now that is true, obviously, most fully in the future, in the lives forever with God that Jesus died to win for us. But it is also true now. Life to the full, proper human flourishing, comes from living for Jesus. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that Christians have a pain-free existence, but it does mean that there is no better life than one lived knowing Jesus as the Good Shepherd. And Jesus uses this picture of sheep and shepherd for a very good reason. A sheep without a shepherd is a fundamentally mournful thing. In Matthew 9, I think I've got it on the screen. No, I don't. Matthew 9, 35 to 38, Jesus is going around the towns and the villages and he's preaching to people. And he comes across this huge crowd of people and he looks at them and he's filled with gut-wrenching compassion. The kind of pity and sadness you can feel in the pit of your stomach. And the reason he looks at them and is filled with compassion for them is because they are like sheep without a shepherd. See, sheep without a shepherd is a fundamentally mournful thing. A sheep without a shepherd are lacking the kind of loving, good, caring leader whose absence leaves you impoverished. The kind of leader who loves his people to be willing to die for them. The kind of leader who works only for the good of his people. The kind of leader who holds his people fast no matter what happens. See, human flourishing does not come as a result of me deciding what's best for me. Human flourishing comes from me following the right person. And so what gets held out in the New Testament over and over again is a choice. Live for yourself and decide how best to live and you'll be fundamentally lacking. Or live for Jesus and let him rule over your lives and you will flourish. It's counterintuitive. And it's countercultural, but flourishing comes not from the freedom to decide how to live for yourself, but from submitting to Jesus as the good shepherd. And lastly, this better story includes a better hope. As creatures seek to live in accordance with the Creator's design, as followers of Jesus, we have hope. And that hope is wonderfully on offer for those struggling with gender dysphoria. Let me put up Revelation 21 on the screen. It says this. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. And there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Now that is a future I am so excited for. I long for that day where Jesus is going to wipe every tear from my eye. And it is equally amazing news for people who are struggling with their gender identity. This is the hope that one day their gender dysphoria, that suffering they experience as a result of feeling like they are the opposite gender to the sex they were born in. This is the hope that one day that dysphoria will be replaced forever with euphoria. There's a book on sale downstairs. I honestly think it is the single best book that I've read on the transgender stuff, called God and the Transgender Debate. And Andrew Walker in it just says this: how brilliant it is to think of God one day saying to the person with gender dysphoria who waited faithfully, "Well done. I know it's been so hard. It's over now. I love you so much that I have brought you to a place where who you feel you are and who you truly are completely enmeshed." Oh, what a wonderful hope that one day dysphoria will be replaced with euphoria. Here's what I want us to do before we jump into the, well, how do we as Christians love our classmates? Just think through those 3 points. What do you find encouraging about what the Bible says about flourishing? And why is our certain future hope better than the hope that the world offers someone like Nikki? Go. 5 minutes in your groups.
Yeah.
Shall we bring our discussion to a close? Come back together. Now, the reason we want to just recap, because I'm sure Andrew said loads of that in the first two sessions. The reason we just want to recap is before we talk about loving individuals, we just want to be really clear in our own minds that what we have as Christians, the gospel story, really is better. We have something better to offer people. We're not offering them an alternative, but something better. Here are just a few things. Now, none of this is going to be particularly like groundbreaking or different. They're pretty simple things, but actually put together, I think they are helpful things to help us love transgender people who might be in our schools or colleges. The first is this: what we are aiming for in our relationships and engagement with them is compassion without compromise. Francis Schaeffer was this Christian theologian who did loads of thinking about how Christians should relate to other people, how Christians should relate to non-Christians. And he once said that there is nothing more ugly than a Christian orthodoxy, a Christian who holds to the truths of the Bible without understanding or without compassion. It's an incredibly helpful point to make. If our approach to people who experience gender dysphoria was to sit them down and like coldly explain to them why they were wrong and why it would be better by far to live according to their birth sex, then we would be failing to love them. We wouldn't be showing them much compassion. And actually, we want those two things. We want to hold to the truth of Scripture whilst loving and being compassionate to people who struggle. And there's two other ways you could think about this. One is you could think about this as the balance between grace and truth. Grace and truth. And the Bible often holds these two things together, grace and truth. At the beginning of John's Gospel, he tells us, when he's describing the incarnation of Jesus, that the Word, that's Jesus, became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. Paul, in his letter to the Ephesians, tells them that when they're interacting with each other, when they're talking to each other, they should speak the truth in love. John, the Apostle John, at the beginning of his second letter, says, "Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love." John Stott was a vicar in London for many years, a really influential guy, wrote loads of books. And he once said that our love grows soft if it's not strengthened by truth, and our truth grows hard if it's not softened by love. So what we're aiming for is compassion without compromise, truth and love. And that means when we're engaging people with gender dysphoria, or we're talking to people who support transgenderism, we can't lose sight of the fact that we are talking to and we are talking about real people who experience real suffering as a result of their gender dysphoria. People made in the image of God who are suffering. The other way to think about compassion without compromise is walking a middle ground between yuck and yes. Yuck and yes. And those are two really common responses to transgenderism. Yuck was the reaction that was the standard one when I was at school far too long ago now. You know, the reaction of yuck. That's disgusting and wrong. That is not a thought-through response. It's not a loving response. And it's not the response that Christians should have to people. Yuck isn't an option. But neither is yes. Yes is the reaction you read about most in the news or online. It's the reaction that's fully affirming of transgender lifestyles. It's built on the idea of, it's great to just be yourself. Embrace who you are. It's not really a response that is consistent with the Bible. Clear as the Bible is that we are sinners in need of grace. It's not the reaction which should be held by Christians seeking to show compassion without compromise. We can't go for yuck and we can't go for yes. So what's the correct response? What's the distinctive Christian response? I wish I'd brought a whiteboard with me. A few years ago, I was living and working on a council estate in central London. And we were doing a lot of work with a lot of Muslims who were living on the estate with us. And we were trying to reach out to our Muslim neighbours and share the gospel with them. And I listened to a really helpful talk that said, why don't... Oh, well, here's a pen. I hope I'm not... Kathy won't mind, will she? Nobody tell her. We'll blame someone else. I said basically, if you drew a diagram like this, and you put people here and ideas here. And you had his point. He was talking about how we relate to our Muslim neighbours, and he said, "Well, you get a load of people in the liberal media who go, well, you know what? I love my Muslim next door neighbour. They're a lovely person, and so therefore, I must love what they believe. It must be their beliefs must be fine and right and can be embraced." And then you get these really horrid groups like the EDL. They were the group that was big at the time that was saying, well, actually, I hate the ideas in Islam. And so therefore, what I'm going to do is hate my Muslim next door neighbour. And this guy was saying, actually, in that situation, it becomes a distinctively Christian response to say, well, I'm going to love my Muslim next door neighbour, even whilst I oppose their beliefs or their ideologies. And I think there's something similar here. We could get rid of these now. With the trans thing and the yuck and yes. Actually, it is a distinctively Christian position to love the transgender people at your school, even whilst not agreeing with the ideology or the ideas or the beliefs that are behind them. And so there are, I think, let me just give you three ways that we can achieve this last row of loving people, even whilst we oppose some of the beliefs that stand behind their transgender lifestyles. And the first is this: welcome them. Welcome them. There's an organisation called the Christian Medical Fellowship. There's just a bunch of doctors who get together and they write helpful Christian papers on different medical issues. And they made the comment that many transgender people experience profound loneliness, sometimes aggravated by the shame and the rejection they often feel projected towards them by religious people. And that's sad, isn't it? That transgender people often experience profound loneliness. Loneliness. So that kid in your school who is struggling with their gender identity or who is identifying as the opposite gender, Well, actually, they might be experiencing profound loneliness. And so the church and CUs and Christians must become places and people where transgender people feel loved and welcomed. We need to be a place as a church where those individuals can find community and friendship, not just guilt and shame. I mean, I feel like it's quite a revealing question, but how welcoming to a gender dysphoric person would your church or your CU or your youth group be? And the answer is, it should be massively welcoming to them. We did a series of talks here, Steve, the vicar, and I, on identity issues. And the line that we used at the end of every single sermon was, so some of them were on just identity in general, some of them were on homosexuality, some of them were on transgender identities. And our line at the end of each sermon was, if you are here, and if you are struggling with any of the issues we've spoken about, can I just say, you are very welcome here. We love you, and we'd love to meet you and chat with you and know what it's like to be you. That's how we left each one, because we wanted them to feel welcome. You are so welcome here. I think this helps us with the next thing that's going to come up on the screen, because it makes us think through our response as more than simply one conversation. Actually, what we're looking for is an ongoing dialogue in the context of community. Actually, what we want is friendship. And one of the key challenges facing evangelical Christians is being able to befriend transgender people. Now, wonderfully, Jesus was a great example of someone who loved people who were on the margins of society. He ate and he drank and he sat with the marginalized and the sinner. He ate dinner with tax collectors and sinners. He came for those who are sick and needy and despised by the religious elite. I think we've got to get ourselves in a bit of a habit of welcoming people, loving sinners, and pointing them towards Jesus. I mean, it would be a tragedy, wouldn't it, if the church became a place where sinners who are in need of a saviour were unwelcomed and unloved. It would deny them the chance to hear the good news about the good shepherd who lays down his life for the sheep. It would dishonour our King who ate with sinners. And for us personally, I wonder whether that means being a bit more intentional with getting to know people in our classes or our contexts, our clubs, who are struggling with their gender identity. And in doing so, not just thinking of them as projects, because I want to share the gospel with them, but as people who I want to befriend and get to know. The other kind of big block to this friendship thing, I don't know if you ever feel this, is sometimes I feel really apprehensive about becoming friends when I know there's this big area of disagreement that exists between us. So easy to end up feeling like, well, how can I befriend that person? There's this huge disagreement that's going to rear its head and that's going to stop the chance of us becoming friends. What we've done, actually, in the UK, in the Western world, is we've made agreement be one of the foundation blocks to friendship. But actually, we know deep down that that's nonsense. That's nonsense. I have a wife. She's not here. Her name is Sarah. She was meant to be doing this seminar as well. Sarah and I have a very happy marriage. Sarah and I do not agree on 50% of things we end up talking about. And yet that disagreement doesn't stop us having a really good relationship. Actually, I can't think of a single friend I've got who I agree with about everything. The need to agree on everything is not a foundation of friendship. And without a shadow of a doubt, you will find areas of continuity and similarity and shared interests with transgender people in school. So being intentional about building friendships. And the final one is focusing on the gospel. One of the real dangers when we're thinking about the correct response to transgender people or dysphoric people is that it kind of leads us down a path of thinking where we're telling them about how they should feel or how they should act or how they should think. So our responses end up like authoritative decrees announcing the truth. Sorry, I've lost my place. The problem is that the very first thing we want people to hear us say is the good news, right? The good news comes first. What comes first is not what you have to do for Jesus, but what Jesus has already done for you. I don't know if you've got a Bible with you, but we're going to open it up to Matthew 16 in just a moment. Someone much wiser than me once said, I fear that if you were to ask the average LGBTQ plus student the tenor of gospel presentations aimed at them, they would say the emphasis isn't on Christ's free offer of grace, but on the sacrifice required from them. They often hear about Jesus' call to come and die, sell all they have, forsake their mother, father, and even their own identities. However, they rarely hear about God's love for them when they fail in these struggles. If you've got your Bible open, turn to Matthew 16. It's all right if you don't, but most of you have got phones and they got a Bible on. So turn to Matthew 16. Just to make this point. Matthew 16, verse 24 says, "Then Jesus said to his disciples, 'Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it.'" Now, obviously, this is absolutely vital for people to hear. Right, it's got some pretty important implications for a transgender person who comes to faith. However, it's really important for us to realize that this call to lose your life for the sake of following Jesus comes after Jesus' pronouncement that he was going to die for the sake of others. So that's verse 24. But look at what comes first in verse 21. "From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life." See, it is significant that verse 21 comes before verse 24. Jesus tells his disciples what he's going to do for them before he tells them what they need to do for him. He's asking the question, are you willing to give up everything? But are you willing to give up everything for the sake of the one who gave up everything for you? So when we do get onto conversations with our transgender friends about the gospel or about our faith, then we've got to get this the right way round. Our response needs to put what Jesus has done for us front and center. Verse 21 must come before verse 24. Now look, we're going to go back into our groups just for the last little push. Here's the question. Which of those things, compassion, compromise, welcome, friendship, putting the gospel first, would you find easiest with that transgender bloke at school? And which one would you find hardest? And why? Both of them should come with a why. Why would you find that easy? Why would you find that hard? Go for it. Shall we come back together? I'm very, very conscious that what we've just done is kind of rattle through a whole load of stuff really quickly, and there might be a whole bunch of questions about the specifics or about how you might go about doing some of this stuff. And although there is going to be the opportunity for a Q&A when we go back in there, and apparently there is still time if you want a slip to submit a question down there, I guess there's also an opportunity for you to ask questions here about some of the stuff we've looked at. But only if there is some. You don't feel the pressure to ask questions, but if you had questions, please do. Yes. I think that's a really good question. Two steps towards an answer, because I guess it will differ within the context of different relationships. But two things that help are actions and consistency, right? Actions and consistency. So two stories of where I've heard of this working with people who are same-sex attracted rather than transgendered, but a similar kind of principle. One is a chap who someone told me about decided that even though he was a Christian, and he thought, right, well, if I am meant to love same-sex attracted people in my school, I am going to take an active role in a student council they had at their school or whatever it was, stamping out homophobic bullying. And so he got really involved in stopping homophobic bullying, which just baffled people that here was this guy being so loving to them, and yet who didn't ultimately agree with what they were doing. Two things that happened there are he acted on loving people rather than just said it, and he did it consistently over his time at sixth form, and it led to a couple of friendships forming. The other one was there's this chap in America. He works for a really conservative organization, right? There's no way anyone would be under any illusions about what his position on these things was. And he was living in one of these apartment complexes in America that has like shared swimming pools and hot tubs and all this kind of stuff. And he said his regular routine after work ended up being to go to grab a beer, go downstairs, sit in the hot tub, and the two people that were always in the hot tub at the same time were his lesbian next door neighbours. And he said they fully knew where I was coming from, but because I went down every day and I sat in that hot tub with them and we talked about our day to day lives, not about the issue we disagreed about, we actually ended up having a really lovely friendship. So I wonder whether there's just there is actions and there's consistency. But there's also finding shared interests as well, right? So you could have a friendship with a transgender classmate built around a mutual love of, I don't know, whatever, Brighton and Hove Albion. Or whatever it is, you could legitimately find something that you have a shared interest in, and that be the way into a friendship with someone. And not every question in practice will become about the transgender issue, and yet consistent love shown over time will help build friendships. It doesn't mean it's not hard, and it doesn't mean you won't meet with some rejection. I think that's probably helpful to say. Abby?
I was just going to say, I so agree with your comment. The default is that if you disagree, you are labelled as as phobic.
Yeah.
And that is just, it's so easy to hate something, it's so easy to be scared of something if you don't know that thing.
Yeah.
And so they need to see who we are, they need to know us, and we need to open ourselves up to them.
Yeah.
We need to open our homes to them.
Yeah.
And welcome them in, and then they will stop seeing the hate and the fear.
Yeah.
Because they're scared of us as much as they think that we hate them.
Mm.
And so if we can love them in that way, you know, invite them out for dinner.
Right.
Just open your homes up, and then suddenly, I've been called phobic by so many of my daughter's friends.
Yeah.
But they come and eat my food, and they chat to me, and they're friendly to me, and they're nice to me.
Right.
And those labels start to go away.
I've got a friend who, should probably cut these stories out of the recording. He's got a friend at the moment. His daughter has her best friend is struggling with her gender identity. And what's this guy done? Is he has just? They know he's a Christian. They know he's a conservative. He has gone out of the way to love his daughter's friends as much as possible. She comes around for dinner. He's praying with his daughter about her. He's like genuinely asking after her to find out how she is because he genuinely wants to care. And I do think that genuine care, shown with actions as well as words, over a period of time, will seep out into friendships. Even if there's some rejection, and even if there's just like an underlying like tone of confusion in the friendship going forward, that's fine. And actually, you know, part of being a Christian as well, we go through that pain barrier, don't we, for the sake of other people. We know there are people made in the image of God who are struggling with dysphoria and who are lonely in our schools. And so if we're going to show the compassion and selflessness of Christ, then we should be willing to face rejection by them for the sake of trying to love them. Sorry, that's, again, another waffly answer to your very good question. So thank you very much for asking. Yeah. Yeah.
It's likely that the friendship group is very little anyway. So whatever that issue they have,
yeah,
transgender or other things.
Yeah.
And at one point, your ideas will surface. Your belief, the core belief will surface. So
yeah.
You basically try just smooth it over or just stand firm. So you stand firm. But the problem is the friendship. Fairly deep, and the expectation from the person who's being rejected, circle of friends rather limited. So the disappointment is sort of proportional to the friendship there.
I agree. But just because we've got to go in just a second, I just think we are also in danger of making this scarier than it might be. So actually, I've got lots of friends who I have deep disagreements with over their lifestyle and their sexual choices. I am in a couple of months going to the wedding of a friend who has been sleeping with and living with her non-Christian boyfriend for the last 3 years. Now that is a big area of deep disagreement between us, and yet a friendship exists. I guess what I'm trying to say is that friendship can overcome those barriers, and actually friendships can be respectful of each other's views. Actually, you'd hope that in this thing where you are being respectful of their views, in that you are trying to love them and draw alongside them, they would be respectful of your views. And actually, if they're not. Take the hit. We're trying to do Christ-like living so that we can love these lonely and suffering people. And so this might open us up to a whole world of pain, trying to befriend these transgender people. But it could be utterly, utterly worth it. Can I pray? And then we better nip downstairs for the final session.